Hello. I'm Kerry O'Brien, with a very croaky voice. And first, before I interview our wonderful guest, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respect to elders past and present, with which I'm sure Don concurs. Don Watson is one of the great reflectors of contemporary life. And while the images reflected aren't always ones we're going to enjoy seeing, we know we need to see them, and we can at least do so knowing we're going to enjoy the writing and appreciate the insights behind it. Don is a satirist, and in fact reminded me that in the days when he was writing satire for the wonderful Max Gillies, several of their performances were in this theatre. Political speechwriter, essayist, Australia's widest ranging historian at large. His latest book, there it is again, is an eclectic collection of his work over the past two decades, which is a very nice way to revisit some of the best of this man's literary and historic and philosophical journey over the years. Don Watson. And now, Don, I'd like to try and capture what I might call the random charm of this book right at the start with a bit of a flick through before we settle down to a few essential themes. You wrote a piece for The Monthly in 2005 called Once a Jolly Lifestyle, which starts with you walking into a hairdressing salon in the Victorian Wimmera town of Horsham, and it develops into a lament of how the bush has changed, about country people before they came to be called rural and regional Australians. When they were the living embodiment of their work and environment, you write, as seals are to rocks and owls to the night, elemental Australians, pioneer communities. So what were you lamenting?
I'm never quite sure what I'm lamenting, but it's just a general lament about many things. But in that, I think it was probably the sorts of people who were around when I was growing up in South Gippsland on a little dairy farm. People who were meta-laconic, you know, it was hard to get a word out of them. And who never took the roll-up out of the corner of their mouths, and there was hardly ever a light, you know. But people like that who had always had two or three fingers missing, rabbit traps or saws or something. We would now say they were, you know, if you could get enough out of them, you would have found that they were narrow and bigoted and whatever. You'd also find that some of them were damaged by war or other things in their life, bad parenting. They were sort of chipped out of the earth in a way.
But they weren't necessarily, I mean, a bigotry that comes with a narrow kind of educated background, maybe, but values often which were good core solid values, and there was a big pacifist streak in the bush that continued to show itself right up to the common day, and I wondered whether that the source of that wasn't in those memorials that you still see in every bush town.
For sure, and I think Ken Inglis once pointed out that you can actually, if you look at the names on those memorials, you can actually figure out the figures of Australian involvement in the First World War. You know, that it was 300,000 went, roughly one-fifth of those were killed. God knows what happened to the other. My grandfather came back, as they all were, changed men, rather violent in his tempers, and God knows what, kicked the mother out, my grandmother, and raised the three boys with a stock whip, basically.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff was all swallowed and hidden, you know. None of them went to shrinks or anything, or got counselling or any of that stuff. They just lived with it. But the bigotry, you know, would be by our own standards. We actually had an Aboriginal bloke who, I don't know what my father paid him. He didn't have any money, so he must have paid him in scones or something, I think. And he lived in a tent under the cypresses, and he worked away. But I can remember some of the things which were said about him. People, and my father's friend, he kept a couple of Aborigines in a fibro cement hut about half as big as this platform. I mean, the days were different and attitudes were very different. It'd be outrageous now. But it was, it went with just sort of general Presbyterianism in those days.
But you lamented the sort of local institutions that were built for different things that were now being used in a much different way.
Sure.
The banks, the old wonderful old bank buildings, and even the churches that were no longer in use.
That's quite true. I mean, the destruction of country towns in Australia isn't as bad as the US, but it's bad just the same. You know, if you go out to Western New South Wales, there are some beautiful towns out there. There's nothing like them on earth. Orange and Forbes and those sorts of places, and it's the same in much of Victoria. But so much of it has been taken away. You know, they knocked the verandas down. They put up these awful gimcrack things in the middle of town, service stations and God knows what. In one sense, I'm a sort of low-born high Tory, I think, some mornings. I hate seeing that destruction of anything, you know, forests or buildings, the Victorians put a lot of effort into building towns and cities. And really, since the Second World War, we've hardly built a decent public building in these places. We put in swimming pools. That's probably the one civic amenity that the post-war generation did. But we knocked an awful lot of stuff down in the name of progress. Mm. There was always a progress association in these towns, and they usually had a couple of developers, small scale, fairly influential in them.
On the council?
Yeah, that's right.
I used to cover council meetings when I was a young journalist, and the number of times Alderman A would come up and whisper to you at lunch about how the new road going in just happened to end at the driveway of Councillor B.
That's right.
And there was no one in between. And then Councillor B would come and mutter about some other dark act that was going on with Councillor A.
Yeah.
That was my early grounding in how politics works universally.
Yes. Yes, and Russ Hiddens took it to an art form in Queensland.
He certainly did. He
big,
certainly
big
did.
Hooks ran through his quarries and down to the...
Now, on more than one occasion, you talk about values being co-opted and draw a distinction between traditional values and values-based politics.
Yes. I mean, I hate the word values. When you see it, particularly in business documents, you immediately suspect something, you know.
It appears a lot in bank documents.
Oh.
Bank mission statements.
Along with transparency and accountability and corporate social responsibility, CSR, and much more. The values thing is, to give you a very contemporary example to show that I'm still reading the papers, I noticed that the new coach of the Australian cricket side, a batsman I admired, says that what happens in the Australian team is elite mateship. Elite mateship.
Oh, do they have their own form of political correctness?
No, it seems that way. But in there he said it's elite mateship. It's like a nightclub, he said.
Because you can't be an elite unless you're politically correct.
No, well, I suppose that's right. That's a kind of take I hadn't made at this point. I was fascinated by the idea that elite mateship is like a nightclub. I haven't been to a nightclub probably in my life. But I didn't imagine that mateship went on in there. But I suppose it does.
Of a form.
Yeah.
I'll move on to the piece that appeared in The Age in 2004 you wrote about, and this is the title, Why We Loved the Other PM, and started with an exchange between Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall from To Have and Have Not, and this is Bacall speaking. You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything, and you don't have to do anything, not a thing. Or maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow. And the Steve you were writing about was...
Steve Waugh, yeah. Yeah, well, I love film noir and Lauren Bacall, of course, and Bogart. But I thought Waugh was a really interesting character. I think he might have been the last of the cricketers, Ponting to some extent, who, as great sportsmen do, somehow embody something essential about what you would like the country to be like. I don't mean sledging, and Steve was a shocker at that. He'd even put his hand over his mouth so you couldn't see. But he was a pugnacious, fearless sort of an individual. And he had that beautiful right-hander's square drive, which was I think I mentioned in that article, it was a bit like Bogart shooting somebody.
That's
you know, just from the hip, you always just shot from here.
That's right.
Look him in the eye and shoot him.
Yeah. We can't have loved him just for his square drive. That would be like loving Humphrey Bogart for the way he shot people. Come to think of it, there was something wonderful in Bogart's cold stare into the eyes of his adversary and the way he fired from just in front of his coat pocket.
Yeah, yeah, well, that was Steve. I mean, the other great thing about war, of course, was that he had a backstory. He had this weakness in his character, which film noir characters always have, you know, whether they've got vertigo like James Stewart or, you know, like Robert Mitchum in Out of the Past, which I think is, you know, the greatest Hollywood film of all time. But, I mean, Steve had this thing about, you know, not hooking. You know, he'd been undone and thrown out of the team, so he refused to ever hook. Even if you tossed one up a lolly drop, you know, at his head, he'd still duck under it, you know, because he would not hook. And that reminded me of a kind of, you know, a bloke who had this weakness that he was going to overcome, and that becomes actually his strength.
Mm. My favourite cricket captain, really, and I never sat down and tried to puzzle out why. I didn't really feel I knew him all that well. I knew I'd like him when I met him, and I interviewed him twice in the end. We didn't get involved in great discourse, but there was something about him. And I wasn't at all surprised when he started up his foundation in India in support of women.
Yeah.
And girls, and in one sense, in that kind of way of the Australian male, unpredictable, and particularly in a culture like India's, that would be so alien to a lot of the guys. If they'd never played cricket in India, they would have probably had no interest in it, whatever.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, that Indian connection was extremely admirable, and I went to India and you'd see his picture up on walls all over the place, and everyone knew about Steve Waugh. In fact, if you get a call from a call centre, if you mention Steve Waugh's name, you can actually easily get off the subject you are otherwise on. You know.
Which wasn't going anywhere anyway.
That's right. Yeah, they're telling you to try unplugging it and putting it back, they say.
Now, you in calling it Why We Loved the Other PM, in the end, of course, there comes the reference to the other PM.
Which PM would that be?
In real life, of course, the one who looks less like Humphrey Bogart or Robert Mitchum and more like the bit player who opens the safe at gunpoint and is left tied up and gagged is the real Prime Minister, and Steve Waugh is now a private citizen. And even as the PM cheered away, it might have crossed his mind that he, the old bit player, was seeing off yet another star.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Nice piece. So you wrote an Australia Day address one year which started, "My fellow Australians, I have a resting heart rate of 35 beats per minute." And to put this in perspective, a resting crocodile's heart rate is 30. And before I became Prime Minister, mine was 33. Malcolm Turnbull's is on 76 on a good day. And even John Howard had never clocked less than 70. And I'm going to ask you to pick up from there. Hang on, sorry. I'm going to bugger this up. It's 283.
There's a bit of paper in there, I think.
Oh, right, mate. There you go.
How long have you been in this job?
I'm used to working without a script and an auto cue. Next page.
The more I need a flag behind me. The more regularly one drives the pulse up through exercise, the lower it is likely to be at rest, and therein lies my problem. My pulse is so low that when reclining or seated, I'm sometimes barely conscious. More than once, before rising to speak at important dinners, I've been consumed by a palpable sense that I was a python hibernating in a cave. Briefing papers, novels, and newspaper articles have a similar effect on me. I rarely reach the second paragraph without either drifting into a near coma or fighting off a manic urge to shadow box or put out a bushfire. To feel the smoke sear my lungs, to tear and pierce every fibre of my physical being, to break through the comforts of ordinary existence and enter the lowest deep of excruciating pain. You see, it is only when I exercise that I feel truly alive. Yet the more I exercise, the less alive I feel when I am not. Over the years, I have developed certain ploys. Several years ago, I was trying to laugh. I think it was one of Scott Morrison's jokes. When I felt a twinge in my glutes, that was when I discovered I could stretch them just by grinning. Constant repetition of the exercise during meetings, interviews, question time, and while driving has not only kept me awake, but free of soft tissue injuries. Though with the consequence that my grin has developed into something that frightens even me.
I noticed one of the things the ABC has been in trouble for lately is that one of its journalist commentators made some reference to Tony Abbott as the most destructive politician operating in Canberra at the moment, and there was a ruling made that it stepped out of line. Well, I thought it was eminently justifiable myself.
I don't think there'd be that many people that disagree, you know. Yeah.
Well, certainly including Malcolm Turnbull. Mm. You've made a big effort over the years observing and writing about America, some of which is in the book. You went back for the Trump-Clinton campaign in 2016 and wrote a quarterly essay, The Enemy Within, and then borrowed from that visit after Trump was actually elected. And before I go on, by the time you came back here, had you convinced yourself that he was going to be beaten or not?
No, when I came back, I thought that he was a very good chance to win. And but I thought it was, you know, you'd back them both. You'd take even money on Hillary, but you'd have a bit on Trump. I was ultimately the polls just wore me down, and I thought, well, she's going to win.
Yes.
But I think people, trying to work out why Trump won is one of those sort of impossible historical problems. You know, the Democrats are convinced it's because Comey said what he said 10 days out. I heard someone on the television the other day saying that's why that gave Trump the last bit of energy. But on the other hand, the number of votes was so small that if Hillary had, for instance, not called his voters deplorables,
there were several touch moments, weren't there? Oh, I mean,
and if she'd campaigned in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And Michigan, instead of taking them for granted, if she'd been talking to ordinary folk rather than getting up with Beyonce or something in the last week or two, which was like saying to everybody who wasn't Beyonce.
I've heard you before make the distinction between the two Hillaries, and the other Hillary is a Hillary who actually can connect with the crowd. Back in 1983, I was a correspondent in America, and I covered the 84. I covered the 84 Reagan Mondale campaign. Mm. Mondale campaigned like he was on bloody Mogadon. And he was headed for another landslide loss. It was the first campaign I've seen where that kind of seriously tight control by minders and consulting the daily polls was in evidence to me. And it was only in the last 2 weeks of the campaign that Mondale obviously decided he had absolutely nothing more to lose. He was gone. He might as well be himself. And he suddenly, possibly for the first time in politics, became an interesting man. Mm. And he still would have lost, but it would have been a better campaign. He would have won more than the one state he won, which was his own. And so it goes. I mean, it's just got worse, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, different kinds of people said to me early on, and I thought it was obviously true, that she needed to campaign as the good-hearted, socially conscious Methodist that she is. She's brilliant with a small crowd of people. She's incredibly knowledgeable and articulate. But as soon as she went into a higher range, you could feel people recoiling. Now, there may be a misogynist-based reason for that. But for a start...
Well, you can't afford to call it wrong at any point,
no,
can you?
No, even if you're going to be called a misogynist in New York, you won't be called that out west. That always seems to me to be one of the problems, that the east and west coast, what's misogyny there is God's plan in Wisconsin.
Yes.
It's the way things are meant to be. And perfectly strong and decent women object to being it being said that their husbands are misogynist or that they're living under someone's thumb, if they're not.
Yeah.
But I was amazed how the Democrats were so wrong about so much of the country.
And what? They're not necessarily going to get it right now. You keep reading about strategic errors that they're on the way to making, even though there are some huge swings being recorded in by-elections.
There's a really telling thing about this Wisconsin business. You know, there it sits. It was always a progressive state. The Republicans have got it now, and they've turned it into something else. But I reckon this says an awful lot. When George Wallace ran for the Democratic nomination in the 60s, he got a third of the vote in Wisconsin. So under this progressive state was the business of race. And it's all through America. And that's what I think Trump, in the end, I think that's what Trump won it on. I think that the racial, it was more than dog whistling, it was just plain whistling. I think that...
There's a good friend of mine who's quite substantial in the Democratic Party, very smart guy. He analysed Trump's speeches through the campaign, and he said, if you just took the speech at face value, it would sound like an utter dog's breakfast. It was a complete mess, a lot of it incomprehensible. But if you looked carefully, what he was doing, he was just moving from touchstone to touchstone to touchstone. He was aiming for this demographic group here, then that demographic group there, and then that one there, and was very consistent in it. So, and to me, total eye-opener, because the Trump I was hearing and seeing on the campaign was the dog's breakfast Trump. So to underestimate the shrewdness, the cleverness, and the total ruthlessness and the completely unprincipled nature of the man is to do so at your own peril. But you quoted the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, on a Trump presidency as saying, it will be recognised with slavery and the Civil War. It will be recognised with World War I and the Great Depression. It will be recognised with World War II. It will be recognised with the 50s and the red baiting and the witch hunting. It will be recognised with the tragedy of Vietnam as a period of confusion and disaster. That's a big statement. Do you think that's what it is? Do you think it's that bad?
Well, Joe and Lai would say it's too early to tell, but it's... and it is. But I think it is a disaster. But I think the disaster goes back a long way into Republican tactics for the last 20 years or 25 years in the states. The sort of gerrymandering and the voter registration stuff they're doing, and that's a big problem. I think the mistake is to think that Trump is somehow an alien in America, but he actually comes out of deep out of, you know, the basic stock of America. You know, he upset the New England liberals, but he sits happily with Virginia planters. Sometimes you think that American life and politics is really just the sacred and the profane at war all the time. You know, they can't live without this constant drama. I think that's why they forgive Clinton and they forgive Jimmy Swaggart and they forgive all these people who preach one kind of thing, although Clinton never did, of course, but actually act in different ways. This is the drama played out. It's like a passion play. A man falls and a man rises again, and so on. You know, but Trump is a scam merchant. He's a con man. He's a mafiosi. He's all those things. But they go back. They've got deep roots in American life.
So. Is there a fascist there at heart, or is he just applying fascist technique? Because, I mean, in that campaign, he even retweeted a quote of Mussolini's, it's better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. And then then when he was accused of aligning himself with a famous fascist, he defended it, saying it didn't matter if it was Mussolini, it was actually a very good quote. What do you think about, now that he's president, what do you think about comparisons with fascism now? And the seeds of fascism?
Well, I think the seeds of fascism have always been there. I in that essay, I got hold of old Mosse's stuff on fascism. And most of the things that he was doing and saying easily could be made to fit the sort of fascist template, including the way his meetings were conducted, the picking targets, turning up late, so the waiting till the crowd was in a frenzy, the race baiting, the corporatism, all that stuff. It was fascistic. On the other hand, he was just an extension of a very simple political principle that you do whatever it takes. And he just, I mean, what he did, and the manipulation of the media, the way he used the media, of course, he used social media in a way that no one had done before, although Obama had done it very effectively. But I think he realised that the Fox News method of news telling meant that it didn't matter what you say, so long as you're there saying it. So the 4:30 a.m. tweet, and then later, if you happen to be fading on the news, you do another one. That was enough. Most people get their news, you know, when they're in the backs of taxis in New York or when you're on the rowing machine or something. You know, you just... Trump was always there. I think Bernie Sanders pointed out that he got something like 27 minutes of the entire campaign on Fox was devoted to policy. Now, there was nothing on policy at all. It was just... Who's got, you know, like a horse race? Who's in front? Who's got, you know?
Well, that's hardly surprising.
Which does sort of sink the moral core of politics pretty deep. Yes. You know, you're not going to get much on that score.
I just we've had a corrupt president before. We've had more than one, but to me, the last seriously demonstrable corrupt president was Nixon. But then the twin corruptee. Or corrupter was J. Edgar Hoover. Mm. So you had at the most powerful office in the land, you had corruption, and arguably the second most powerful office in the land, you also had corruption, and they were two forms of corruption that served each other. What you've now got is, it would seem, the corruption in the White House, the corruption of power in the White House, the abuse of power in the White House, but you appear to have the rule of law, the instruments for the rule of law holding up at this point. Mm. Do you take heart in that?
Yeah, I think that is the main and only hope. Whether they will hold up remains to be seen.
Partly depends. I mean, if he takes the step too far by any decent benchmark, moral benchmark or ethical benchmark, how many... Republican senators, whether the Republicans hang on to both houses in the midterm elections, up to now they've mostly stayed as his lapdogs, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, they're not a pleasant bunch, this generation of Republicans. I mean, and that started with Gingrich and the rest of them in the early 90s, when they just decided total opposition, something that Tony Abbott learned. You just oppose everything, and you get the states through the Koch brothers and others. Just getting as many of the governorships as they can by the narrowest of margins, and doing it by gerrymandering and getting people off the rolls. So Wisconsin, was another example. You know, Milwaukee was a sort of Labor Democrat town. It's now a kind of ghetto in large part, and you drive through an invisible line, and you're in absolutely bedrock Republican white flightville.
Hmm. Those numbers, the sort of what you would call the core Trump supporters, are absolutely holding together, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Paul Ryan could only think of leaving altogether, you know, as opposed to being brave in the Senate. But I think Ryan was always
a flake.
I met a bloke who knew the Ryan family in Janesville, actually, and
this is Paul Ryan, who was the Speaker of the House.
Yes, he didn't. He said they were a good family. They were Republican. He was a Democrat. This bloke, an old Democratic member of the local House, but he said he didn't know what happened to Paul. But what happened to Paul was that he went off and sat at the feet of Ayn Rand, like the rest of them did, like Alan Greenspan and all the other geniuses who decided what our world would look like. You know, and he became a devotee.
Malcolm Fraser tried to sit at the feet of Ayn Rand, and some instinct must have warned him off. He sort of half-mouthed her. He actually
went
out of his way to meet her.
There, I'm sure.
he went out of his way to meet her, but then his version of Van Randism was a very lukewarm one that he never, he clearly, his heart was never in it.
No, he's an interesting character, isn't he?
Yeah, well, we won't keep going there now because there's far too much ground to cover. But if you, I wonder whether you've started to let your imagination at work about what Trump might be like and how far he might be prepared to go when his back is against the wall, as it may well be almost sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, no one, I don't think anyone can tell. I think I have this sort of strange feeling in a way that, on one hand, he might be what America needed, you know, in the sense that it might shake them and they realise that you just can't have these sorts of characters operating at that level of the political system. It's all right for shady dealers and God knows what influence to be exercised beneath the surface of American politics, but to have a bloke actually put his head up like Trump is just not on.
On the other hand, it's a very big head.
Yeah,
very big head.
Yeah, that's right.
A very big head.
Yeah. And he's
a great head.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the best head in history. But he's that's the most hopeful possibility, and the Democrats will, you know, grow a spine and find a leader. That might
see,
happen.
To me, the quandary is, I think any sane, rational human being would want to see him out of the White House as quickly as possible, which means impeachment, prosecution. But I think for the greater health of the United States, he needs to be voted out, doesn't he?
Would be much better, much, much better. See, this is an odd sort of positive thing to say. You know, if Hillary had won by a handful of votes, God knows what shape that America would be in now, because yeah. The Republicans would have just put the walls up straight away. She'd be undergoing impeachment already.
Yeah.
And Trump supporters, they were never going to accept any vote that didn't go their way. It could be far more chaos than we're presently witnessing.
Yeah. Back in Australia now. You wrote a piece for Good Weekend in December 2003. John Howard was 2 years into his third term. George Bush was in the final year of his first term. Maccabi Diva had just won the first of her three Melbourne Cups. Very important piece of Australian history. Your piece is headed, "What Will History Make of Us?" And you wrote, "History might decide that ours was the age when people began to live as tropical fish do, off each other, aware only of what they need and what threatens them, changing colour with their emotions, lacking any sense of provenance or fate or life on either side of the moment in which we live, in which they live. They were free of all faith, the historians might say, and they gave up their collective ideals, history and language all at once. They fashioned their lives according to their self-interest and their vanity." If you were writing a piece under that headline today, 15 years later, would you change any of it? Or would we just be further down the same road?
I haven't read that piece for 15 years. I don't think I'd change much of it. Probably nothing. I think that's pretty well the way we've gone. You know,
this doesn't all just lie at the feet of disappointing politicians, does it? It doesn't just lie at the feet of the moribund nature of our two-party system now. It is partly about the nature of the world that is all around us, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's not unconnected to neoliberalism, whatever that term means. When we went from... You know, you and I grew up in a political environment in which there were 60 or 70% of Australians who were unionised, of Australian workforce. Even though the Labor Party was split, you know, at least the two sides stood for something that was firm and, you know, easily enough understood. The Liberals called themselves Liberals, but were in fact Conservatives, and that was fine. I mean, it was all pretty clear. But a lot of things of that kind have slipped away. I think another thing that slipped away that no one's really noticed so much is that the non-conformist churches, which, along with the Catholic Church, actually formed a very important part of progressive politics in Australia. If you remember, Paul Keating's deputy was Brian Howe, a practicing Methodist and somebody with a kind of Hillary Clinton sort of vocation for doing good in the community. A very modest man. Phil Kelty once said he had a charisma bypass, but that was not... he said it was like the Seven Samurai. If you followed Brian into a town, they were all hiding inside after he'd been through. He'd been sort of peering through. People were cruel, but that was a strong thing. I mean, John Button was a Presbyterian minister's son, and they were drawn to the party by a sense of whatever their
social obligation.
By social obligation, there was a bit of noblesse oblige about it. All that seems to me to have gone, and it is there was a collective. Collectivism. It's funny that we talk so much about mateship and values now. Those days have largely gone too. I mean, mateship is now talked about more than it ever was and practiced less, it seems to me.
Yes.
We talk as if we're the only people who are mates, you know. There are friends in other parts of the world. they're not always up at night trying to stab their best friend in the back, you know. It's a dodgy thing, mateship. But the... I don't know that it's all bad, happened, but it's certainly
the,
very
the
difficult.
Irony, the great irony in it all, Don, is that any working class parent would have wanted their child to get a better education than they had. Mm. That whole thing of aspiration was once a good word, and now it's taken on the form of a dirty word in the mouths of some. Mm. The aspirational class now is associated with greed. It's associated with those McMansions and so on. And it's associated with that people who might once have almost automatically voted Labor now see part of their aspiration to be prosperous enough to vote Liberal. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a part of what's happened, isn't it?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, we are a more educated nation, but a part of that education associated at the same time with the great media age, the great advertising and marketing age, and the age of greed, mm. which you associate with neoliberalism, but it's kind of broader than that.
With neoliberalism, but with neoliberalism you associate with what's called the knowledge economy, where people sort of work work with information rather than with tangible goods. So the language has been adapted to that, and we've lost the meaning of, well, we've lost thousands of words that used to be in currency. Lifestyle has come to replace life, you know. He had a short and happy lifestyle,
Moving forward.
There's a place in Geelong, I kid you not, a funeral director's called Lifestyle Funerals.
I once found a town in America, in Amish country actually, called Intercourse. And the next town beyond it was Paradise.
And beyond that?
I was actually there to report on Peter Weir. Peter Weir was making the film Witness. Mm. But I just had to write the words for a piece to camera explaining that I was in Intercourse and Paradise was just over the hill.
I thought you were going to say you wrote it on the sign. You're like a landlord.
I think somebody had to... Probably they had somebody fully employed constantly having to clean up the
absolutely.
Sign.
Absolutely.
You wrote on political leadership, and this is in August 2011, so we're sort of creeping closer to the present day. It is now all but universally agreed that the Australian Labor Party is a near ruin, ruled body and soul by factional bosses and opinion pollsters. And you went on to describe what you called the operaisation of Australian politics... where the natural posture of a politician had once been chief amongst equals, it was now at best equal amongst equals and commonly last or least amongst them. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, it's early. I think I began to form that opinion watching Q&A. I don't know, where there were some nights there where you thought, who's the star of this show? Is it Anthony Albanese or Bill Shorten or Julia Gillard or is it Tony Jones? Well, I like Tony Jones and all that.
Yes.
But really, there were times when the politicians just seemed to be, really begging for forgiveness or just putting their hand up, can I have an opinion, And I think
One of the tricks about Q&A to me is that the politicians can't afford, some of them have strayed over the line spectacularly on a few occasions, but they can't, in their minds would be the mantra, they can't afford to attack too heavily those questioners, where they might give Tony an easy backhander. Mm. They don't really want, they know it's risky to be seen to do that to quote unquote ordinary real dinky die Aussies asking
the
questions.
Yeah.
And so there is a sense that they are slightly captured by that.
Yeah. I think it's true. I don't think anyone has convincingly explained why we felt since probably Howard, and some of us during Howard, that there really hasn't been a politician, even if they were of substance, been able to display some substance. It has felt since about 2007 as if every prime minister is just passing through. And this is a phase we'll get over. If you remember, I remember Joe Bjelke-Petersen, we kept thinking he won't last. But he lasted for 17 years.
I mean, and 19.
19 was what we've... But we've
I was
nearly...
there for some of it. I had no illusion, mate. There was a period where the Labor Party was... Labor in the Queensland Parliament was reduced to a cricket team. With a gerrymander like that and the ruthlessness and the state of Labor, it was clear when you were close up to it that he was there for the long haul. And it just got worse. I mean, that is... probably the best case to illustrate of power corrupting in this country and how absolute power can corrupt absolutely.
Mm. Yes, well,
but I digress.
Yeah, that's all right. It's a weird time. It hasn't felt at all as if anyone has been in control.
Well, everyone's lost their way, including the media.
Now, this might have something to do with the fact that, you know, with 2007, 2008, the collapse of the whole neoliberal thing, and with the collapse of as faith in this neoliberal model, which Hawke and Keating got going, certain kinds of politicians fell with it. Like triangulation no longer worked. It worked for Clinton, it worked for Blair, it worked initially for Rudd, but then it began to fall apart. This is after the event, of course, but I remember an interview you did with Rudd. And I thought, this is disastrous. The inner child is escaping here. And the people, the mob are going to see it.
Mm.
And it's going to be a big problem for him because he suddenly looked like he was featherless. And 3 weeks later, he was gone.
Mm.
And when he was talking about, it might be all right for you out in 730 land, or he went on like this, and he thought, no, this is pathetic.
At that moment, he became more interesting to me. Because what showed was a combination of real anger and real frustration, and he really had poured himself heart and soul into fighting the climate change fight at Copenhagen, and he really had sleepless nights and worked 24 hours a day with Penny Wong to try and get a win, and then his whole world collapsed, and the greatest moral challenge of our time suddenly became too hard politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with him the following February in our green room, and I said, how are you going to recover from this? And that was before the U-turn. And he said, we'll work it out. I said, how? He didn't know.
Hmm.
He did not know how he was going to keep control of that debate, and within a couple of months he'd done his U-turn, and that was the end of the equation.
Hmm.
So this comes back to, for Labor, it comes back to that the moribund nature of Labor connects, whether the factions are a cause or a symptom is an interesting question.
Well, I think, I think to hope that the Labor Party will suddenly transform into a social democratic party and a more democratic party than it presently is probably not a hope worth holding on to. I think it will always be governed by the factions, and when the factions work well, they work very well, and no one complains about them. They work well, Hawke managed them well, and Keating managed them fairly well. And
there were real debates going on within the factions on
sure.
policy,
yeah.
right through the Hawke-Keating years.
Yeah. It means that it means that prime ministers come into the job often with some, you know, doubtful friends. You know, a lot of people talk about Shorten's, you know, dubious friends, but Paul had some dubious friends, and Hawke had. it just happens. It's what politics is like. It's really what you can then make of it. And I think the problem that politicians now have trouble, in a sense, with too much democracy that social media creates. They don't know, you know, I don't know how they operate. You know, we had a fax machine in 1996. That was as much technology as we had.
Yes.
You had to watch that. But now, you know, they get a million emails and a million messages a day, and you've got to somehow have someone to manage all that at the same time, and you're overwhelmed with public opinion and with infinitely
more
polling.
Which is why I would think more than ever the need for the leader to have a core set of, not values, but a core set of principles and a core kind of framework for where they want to lead the country. In policy terms, and the narrative, and that they're not going to be diverted by it, because the 24-hour cycle is such now that it's like journalists have now got themselves caught in the frenzy trap.
Mm.
And one of the most recent frenzies, of course, was the ball tampering with the cricket.
Mm.
And you know these things. I mean, that was a serious frenzy, because that one lasted for about 5 days.
Mm.
Was milked to buggery.
Mm.
And, you know, and I suppose there were some who would have been disappointed that they didn't make the entire cricket team cry. Mm. But then they move on.
Mm.
And then the next frenzy has to at least match the previous frenzy for drama, or we might lose our audience, or we might lose our readers.
Mm.
And so I don't think politicians can ever be allowed to get away with claiming that it's the media's fault. It's both. But a true leader rises above that, doesn't he,
yeah,
or she?
I mean, the thing is, if you're going to have a true leader, I mean, if Labor's going to throw up a leader, I find it hard to believe that the Conservative side will, but they might. But if Labor is throw up a true leader, the first thing that he or she would have to be is a politician, a good politician.
Yes.
They're going to have to find their way through the
factions. Which should not be a dirty word.
Exactly. They're going to have to work out coalitions of like and unlike, and form alliances with people that you might not particularly agree with. All those things are going to have to be done, because it's always had to be done in politics.
So what did you see Malcolm Turnbull make his declaration challenging Abbott for the leadership?
Mm.
What can you remember what you thought as you watched it?
Well, I suppose I was overwhelmed by hope, because, you know, the grotesquerie that he replaced was just, you know, becoming too much.
It was impressive.
Yeah, but the thing I remember
most... One of the most impressive challenges I've seen, in the sense of what he had to say, and the precision and the sense of commitment to it. And then
quite.
What happened?
Well, I think I started to back off a little when he started talking about innovation.
And we're the opposite.
But look, he spoke in complete sentences. I actually wrote a piece saying...
As Paul Keating said to me in the Opera House when we had our conversation there, and I asked him about Turnbull, he said, "Well, it's a very low bar."
Yeah, he's and I think we were overcome with hope that Malcolm would bring. See, he said something really quite cunning. He said, "This will be a truly liberal government." And you want to say small L or big? What are you saying here? And we all hope that it would be, you know, it could be big L, but sort of, I mean, Menzies is a socialist by comparison with, you know, the present bunch of liberals. I don't think any of us expected that he would be subjected to the kind of savagery that Abbott's inflicted on him. But I also think that he hasn't revealed much depth so far. Much, I mean, I think people sense that Malcolm had to have that job. He just wanted that job.
Yes.
On the CV.
And he had form in terms of political judgment, bad political judgment. He had form going way back.
Yeah.
But he clearly aligned him, made too many promises to the nasty end of the right.
Yeah.
And we now have seen a situation where you've got this kind of bizarre, massive department for everything that has any bit of power attached to it with Peter Dutton.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think people are now beginning to feel that Dutton really is leading the government, and I don't think that can be terribly good for Malcolm in the long run. But just, I mean, I think I mean, that's the second thing that you would want in a if a leader was to save us. You would like to think that they believed something quite strongly, that they came with a really strong belief in something. And that's not apparent. So a great example was 2 years ago when the Labor Party plucked up the courage to throw some policy into the debate on negative gearing. The Libs treated it like it was an unexploded device. Yes. You know, they were sort of, throwing rocks at it.
It was.
It was just shocking. What are we going to do about that? You know, stand back. It was phenomenal. It was just a bit of sensible policy, which half the economic press delighted in, you know, even more than half.
So have you written a speech for Bill Shorten?
No. I probably wouldn't own up if I had, but I haven't. I'm in touch with his speechwriter from time to time.
How do you... It would be... the potential for disappointment would be massive.
It is... It can be with better politicians than Bill.
Yes, but you know that there are going to be times when you'll be uplifted too.
What you hope for is someone who's going to believe in the stuff that you're writing and take it beyond that. You know, there's... Paul Lynham once told me that Paul Keating read my speeches like a man reading a Chinese menu. Which is very unfair of him, but I never went to listen, you see.
Well, he wasn't a great orator of the written word.
No.
But he was untouchable when he would sort of hit his straps in a completely ad hoc way.
That was always the tension, and I always thought it was admirable on Paul's part that he always felt that the words in front of him, he could never use an auto cue at all. We tried for 10 minutes and gave it up. But he always felt that those words, the written words, got between him and the audience, and I think that was a genuine and noble political response. But he never really became comfortable with reading speeches, and he would stop.
Well, it wasn't his true style.
No, he was. He used to say, you know, that he would have been a very good defence lawyer. You know, that counterattack was his go, and
well, he once acted as the leading defence lawyer of the Western Australian Royal Commission on Carmen Lawrence without leaving Federal Parliament.
Yeah, it was a spectacular performance.
He demolished a Royal Commission from Federal Parliament.
That was one of his great days in politics. He did more on that day too. It was a phenomenal day's work.
I know you two have fallen out, but do you miss him?
Yeah, I do. He's there a lot of the time, you know. They get into your marrow. I have conversations with him in the shower just about every week. I've got bruised knuckles, you know, from that.
So what did happen?
I wrote a book. Well, there was an essential problem in the book. That was that between one's duties as an historian, and one's duty to a friend, and I thought I'd actually managed to satisfy both those requirements satisfactorily. And I was cheered at about the time of Paul unloaded on me through the fax machine, an unforgettable moment. I got a call from Noel Pearson, who I'd asked to launch the book, saying, "Mate, it's a love story. It's great, it's a love story." So at that very moment, I was thinking, well, this is what it is meant to be. I got, well, there's nothing, no more dangerous condition than love, is there, really? So I got...
Noel wrote, because there was that, and I wasn't there, I didn't see it. I've never seen any film of it. But obviously an excoriating moment when Paul got up and spoke.
It wasn't the usual kind of book launch, no. It was in the Sydney Town Hall. There were thousands there. I think at some point during Noel's speech, Bob Ellis took a swing at Gerard Henderson. And,
And he missed because he didn't lower his sights.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's a pity that didn't... That could have been the great distraction we all needed. But no, Noel... I told Noel, like, if you're coming down from Hope, you know, from Hopevale, don't worry about talking about the book. Just let them know that, you know, what you think. So Noel did for about 50 minutes. People were already beginning to faint. And I, this whole time I had to stand next to Paul, who was just seething with rage. And then I spoke briefly, and then Paul just unloaded on me for, I don't know, felt like an hour and a half.
15 minutes. This is what Noel Pearson wrote subsequently. Keating rose to the microphone in darkest and barely restrained dudgeon. It had been uncertain whether the subject of the biography would appear at all. I stood beside my mate, Don, while the man we truly adored gave a variously erudite, humorous, vicious and thoroughly mesmerising black performance. I could feel the biographer's flesh being surgically pinned to the wall. With no licence to even squirm in protest, it was like watching a seahawk pin its kill with its talons on the perch and slice live fish into still quivering sashimi. Don's biography is an Australian masterpiece, but I've never asked him whether it was worth those 15 minutes.
Yeah, damn it. It was. No, at that moment, I would have said no. I could have just said, pack up or go home now. Don't worry about the book. Off you go. I did think that Noel's description of it as being so surgical was... It felt to me more like an old-fashioned Irish shillelagh that I was being battered with. But... It was excruciating. It was terrible. But
when things calm down in your own mind, and you really, if you ever did try and force yourself to step back from it all and work out what, if anything, from your perspective, Paul might have actually had a point on.
Oh look, I think I know why he felt betrayed. And as someone once said to me, you know, if a person feels betrayed, he is betrayed. And that I can't do anything about. But I think I would have betrayed myself to write it differently. I tried to write it differently. I tried to write a magisterial account. I wrote 60,000 words in this form as if I had not been there, you know. And it felt bogus and dishonest.
But I mean, I read parts of it that I could imagine the very private man that Paul Keating is would have considered to be betrayal. That where... And I'm not talking about him having the right to veto what you wrote or look over it, but things that he would have regarded as very private amongst trusted people.
Yeah, I can imagine he felt that way, although that's not what he ever said to me. He's never told me that that's what hurt him. They weren't the things. The thrust of the things he said to me were that I didn't get, and most of that speech he delivered, that I hadn't made enough of the great reforms that he was responsible for. In other words, I hadn't done the business of building his posterity. It's terribly important to Paul that be so. It's a natural thing. We all want to be well remembered. Some people want it more than others. I don't frankly give a hoot, because I'll be dead. But I have my children remember me well. But beyond that, it's not a point. But I think for people who've been in public life as long as Paul, who've done all those things.
Particularly when it ends in defeat.
Yes, but I think...
As it usually does.
What I would say is that the book is nowhere spiteful. And I never have felt any spite towards him. And I think it's also true.
But it's not only spite that can cause offence.
Oh, sure. But I think that if you read, you know, there are other examples of books. If you read Stephanopoulos's book about Clinton and a whole lot of others, they go for it. And I didn't go for it, really. I just simply wrote from the notes I'd taken at the time, the way it felt to be who I was in that office. And I wanted to give an account of office life as honestly as I could. And the personal bits... huge amounts are left out, as I did say to him on the phone when he gave me room when he was drawing breath. You know, that you know, there is a lot of stuff I could have put in there, mate, that I didn't, you know. And I think that if you wanted to boil it down, I'd accept your point that maybe some of that personal stuff could be left out, but I think it's a very small part of the book. It was a very important part of what was governing his mind at the time, and it was very hard to leave it out. I know it was governing his mind because we talked about it every day.
Right.
And it was, they were horrible decisions to have to make. The decision not to show him the book was as hard as anything I've ever done. Politicians do that sort of thing all the time. They've got to make those sorts of horrible decisions where you do betray people. For me, I mean, I'm just, you know, I found it excruciating. It's why I could never be a politician, I suppose. But I think that...
So your instinct was to show him?
My instinct was to
but
show him,
said
but,
no.
But a very senior member of the press corps I happened to mention to, I said, it's done, I've just got to show it to him. And he said, you're absolutely mad, don't do it. I've never told anyone his name and I won't start now because he'll get a phone call. And I thought, you're right. And that is the seat of the what has unfolded since, really. Not who wrote the speeches and all that stuff. I mean, that's all. That's a horror. That's as bad as anything. You know, the fact that people think that he and I are fighting over who wrote the Redfern speech, a speech written on behalf of Aboriginal people, for God's sake, and there's alleged a fight between us about who wrote it. There's nothing to fight over.
Yeah,
it's Paul's speech.
And we're actually out of time. And there is a chapter. They're not chapters really, but there is a piece in the book that that Don wrote for the 10th anniversary edition of Confessions of a Bleeding Heart, where he goes into some of this stuff as a kind of afterword. Don, you can keep doing this for a long time now because you've written a great deal over the decades, all of it quality. It's a lovely way to challenge the mind and remind ourselves about the history of our times, because it is so easily forgotten these days. Would you please thank Don Watson?